ॐ भरताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्बत्वामनुसंतधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वैषिणी.
Did we get this to Margaret? Okay, we're on verse 7. Chapter 4, verse 7.
Okay. Yada yada hidharmasya. यदा यदा हि धर्मस्य ग्लानिर्भवति भारत ग्लानिर्भवति भारत अभ्युत्थानं धर्मस्य अभ्युत्थानं धर्मस्य तदात्मानं सृजाम्यहं तदात्मानं सृजाम्यहं.
सन्धि. यदा यदा हि धर्मस्य Glanihi bhavati bharata abhyutthanam adharmasya tada atmanam srijami aham.
This is a famous section. This is a famous verse. The section is in this chapter 4 is when Krishna is really talking about himself as an avatar, as an avatar who comes down into the creation as his Ishwar, taking a form, coming into the creation at particular times. And in these two verses he's telling, when do I take a birth, when do I take a form in the creation and why? Why? Because he's answering the question of Arjuna. So he says, so the Shankara introduces this kim artham, as though Arjuna is asking, well, why do you become an avatar? Why do you take this birth in the creation? What's the purpose? And so he says, yada, yada. If you take a word like that, yada means when. So if you say yada, yada, it means whenever. Okay, at whatever time. So whenever he, indeed, yada yada he, whenever, dharmasya glanihi bhavati, there is a destruction. Glanihi is it, what's the synonym that he uses? Hanihi. There's a destruction of dharma. So whenever dharma is being destroyed, is at risk, he bhavata, bhavata is vocative there. So whenever there's a destruction of dharma, and abhyutthanam adharmasya. And abhyutthanam, uttanam means to rise up, to be born. The abhi means everywhere. There's everywhere adharma is rising. So dharma is being destroyed, but in all walks of life, adharma is rising. Tad atmanam srijami aham. Tada, then, so yada, yada, whenever, then, tada, then, aham srijami, I create atmanam, myself. I create myself. Right? Remember, it's very beautiful. So we were talking last week in Swamiji's Bhasha on this, on this verse. He also talks more about Ishwara actually taking a birth. And when Ishwara takes a birth, say if you think of Ishwara as the whole, the conscious being who is the whole. From the standpoint of the Atma, of course, there I am the self and this is my creation. From the standpoint of the creation, there's this world and in this world there are many jivas. So it depends. This is why this Vyavaharika, Paramartika, you know, and Pratibhasika orders of reality are so important. Because say if we say, just a little aside here, say if you say, Advaita, there is I am one without a second. If I'm talking from that standpoint where I say I am one without a second, I'm talking from the standpoint of Paramarthika Satyam, what is absolutely real. That's an order of reality. What happens with if that order of reality isn't understood, then the person from this order of reality will say, well, how come I see you then? Or you can say, if you're liberated, you won't see me. Right? Because in Paramarthika, the absolute reality is just pure Brahman, pure consciousness, pure being. Vyavaharika Satyam is this empirical reality that when experienced within the reality, there's a shared experience that we can all agree this is a lamp. Or we can agree this is a rope, but not all of us will agree this is a snake. If we say it's a snake when it's actually a rope, that's Pratibhasika. That's another order of reality. An order of reality that is not shared. Right? So that's what we call subjective projection. So the Vyavaharika is the shared reality where there are laws and consistency and we can and science applies. All of our studies and all of the different sciences, whether it be psychological internal sciences or external sciences, it doesn't make any difference. There's a shared reality that we can all agree on. That's a Vyavaharika. It assumes the creation. It's what's going on within the creation. So the thing is, then the Pratibhasika is the projection upon the creation. It's outside of the laws of the creation in the sense. It's a projection upon the creation. Of course, in one sense, that projection can take place is still existing within the laws of the creation, but it's still a subjective projection. And so, if we look at the Pratibhasika and the Vyavaharika, these two orders of reality, we have to be able to say that the truth of this order of reality, right, is Brahman. The truth of this order of reality, what is actually here, is pure consciousness, in spite of the names and forms that we perceive. In other words, let me put it that, not in spite of. What I mean by that is that the names and forms that you perceive in this shared reality have for their truth, their substance, consciousness, Brahman. Right? So instead of saying the truth of this table is wood, right? Because that's immediately what your eyes would see. The truth of this table is wood. The actual stuff of this table is wood. We have to go through the Maya, through this world of name and forms, peel it away so that we can see, say that the truth of this wood, the truth of the table is wood, but the truth of the wood is consciousness. Right? The truth of the wood are the cells of the wood. The truth of the cells are the molecules. The truth of blah, 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 blah. But what is the substance inside it all is consciousness. The truth of this is consciousness. The truth of this is consciousness. The truth of this is consciousness. So in spite of seeing and perceiving this world, right, we at the same time recognize its substance as Sat, Chit, Anand, as consciousness, as conscious being. And so when we understand that, there is no problem with us perceiving and existing within a shared reality that we call Vyavaharika, right? Because we see the truth of it is only consciousness, which is my being. And there's no problem with understanding Pratibhasika, also which is a projection on shared reality, on Vyavaharika, like the snake on the rope. But we also see that is nothing but consciousness. Because anything that exists within time and space has for its being consciousness. So that's the vision. So for a jnani, the Vyavaharika and the Pratibhasika, the shared reality and the projected reality, rope, snake, I mean a jnani, one who has self-knowledge, can mistake a rope for a snake too. Right? Can see a man instead of a post. All of this is just part of Vyavahara. So as long as whether you have self-knowledge or not, jnani or ajnani, you're still experiencing the creation. The creation doesn't go away. But you can say, this creation, which I am experiencing, is in fact nothing but consciousness. And you see that clearly. And so all three orders of reality are clearly understood. And because Because your essential nature, the truth of it all, and the nature of your being is consciousness, the me, the self that you are, you also, just the way this upadi is designed, upadi means your, this conditioning adjunct, your body, your mind, sense organs, the way this thing is designed, because there is such a thing as meditation, there is such a thing as withdrawing your sense organs, there is such a thing as quietening down your mind. If you want to, you can pull the organs of knowledge and the mind away from duality and simply have them abide in their own essential nature, which is what? Consciousness. So you can have consciousness with names and forms or consciousness without names and forms. Right? But in any case, it's consciousness. And this is, this is also why you can, it's so, the truth of this is so obvious. If you have an imagination, you can say, this is consciousness with the imagination, consciousness without the imagination. In the dream, when you wake up from the dream, you can say, the dream, when the dream was there, it was so real. When it's gone, nothing has happened. That phenomena, that's why we say that very phenomena right there is considered a real, what Swamiji will say is the Achilles heel to the reality of this universe. And in the Mandukya Upanishad, it also talks that way. You know, the whole, they spend so much time on the dream, but there's this one phenomena to notice, is that when you wake up from the dream, and the dream reality is gone up in a puff like that, it's gone. The recognition that in fact nothing has happened, the names and forms, the universe, the dream universe, all of the characters are gone, but still nothing has happened because existence, the stuff of it, has not changed. What is actually there, the sat-chit, has not changed in any way. And so you don't notice any coming in or going or any creation or any loss. In fact, there is no such thing really as a creation because nothing is created. The stuff of the creation is already there. And so there is no sense of a becoming there, and there is no sense of a loss with the creation, without the creation, with the name and form, without the name and form. Nothing happens. So it's very important to understand these three levels of reality and understand the mityatva means the dependent nature of both the vyavaharika, the shared reality, and the pratibhasika, the projected reality. Both are mitya. Remember what mitya means is that those names and forms that you experience, if something is mitya, the name has absolutely no reality apart from the substance. That's why we use clay pot. Clay pot is mitya. Why? Because it has no reality of its own, apart from the form. It has zero reality. It has no existence, no being, absolutely zero, apart from the clay. When we say this creation is mitya, it means it has zero reality, no being at all. Not in the slightest, nothing, zero, apart from consciousness. And that's why when the nama-rupas, the names and forms, are present, the creation is, or the consciousness is here, what is actually here is here. When the nama-rupa is gone, what is actually here is here, without the slightest change, because the name and form don't offer anything. They don't add to the situation. And so now, here, Krishna is starting out now saying why he comes. Why does he create himself? Later he's going to say, why is it the one who really understands what he's talking about? That person is a Jiva Mukta. Krishna says in a few verses now, we'll get to it today, I think. The person who understands, the one who understands, that person will not be, who really understands, he says, the person who really understands in truth what I'm telling you now, that person will be free. That person will not take another birth. That person just becomes me. It means the ajnana is removed. It recognizes me. Because to really understand what Krishna is saying, you have to understand these three orders of reality, and you have to understand that this order of reality, the shared reality, it has, it's what Swamiji will say is an infinite display of laws. It's an order. It's an infinite order. It is its own infinite system. And so now Krishna is saying, whenever this infinite system, this vyavahara, whenever this shared reality becomes out of balance to the point that the dharma itself is being destroyed and the adharma is rising everywhere, it's rising up everywhere, at that time I create myself. So now, a couple of things. When he says, when the dharma is being destroyed, what that means is because dharma is not an object. You can't burn it or something. The dharma is the what abides in the dharmis. Dharma abides in the people. So, and the dharma is that which gives order and harmony to the universe. It means that the way that a human being is meant to be, that human community is meant to be, what is the natural order of being human? What is the natural order of being an animal? What is the natural order of being a human being? What is that dharma? When that dharma is being destroyed, being overwhelmed by a dharma, so it's two things. The dharmis are being overwhelmed by the adharmis, the ones who are not living within that order. Oh, it's the golden rule. If you want just a simple sadhana dharma. The simple sadhana dharma is do unto others as you would have done to yourself. And don't do to others as you wouldn't have them do to you. That's what we call the sadhana dharma, the general dharma that includes all beings. And on top of that is ahimsa, non-injury. So ahimsa, golden rule, and then all of the kind of the manifestation of in this case do this, in this case do that, in this case do that. But that's kind of the hierarchy of dharma. When the adharma becomes overwhelming, coming up everywhere, and the dharmis have become dysfunctional, say the few dharmis that are left, have no power. They have no power. Swamiji said in his bhasha, all they can do is sit and pray. He used to say, there's 100 adharmis who could care less about dharma or any type of moral code to 20 dharmis. And the dharmis are kind of, you know. And so that moral order has to be established. So when in the order of things there seems to be that severe imbalance has come up, at that time Krishna says, speaking as Ishwara, speaking as the Lord, says, at that time I manifest myself, I create myself. Lord, earlier he said, through the use of my own maya, I create myself. What that means is I enter into the creation. I myself, this is my creation, it's my projection, and that's the whole talking. So just don't think of the infinite creation, say, this is my creation. It's not a voice like that. It's the law. And when that infinite creation, what we call Ishwara, that infinite being, infinite manifest knowledge, this situation evokes that. It evokes that entry in order to put into order. And in the next verse he'll say, in every yuga, doesn't have to be even once in a yuga, it just says in every yuga, in every period of time, when this situation occurs, at that time, I come into this creation. Now from Ishwara's standpoint, what order of reality is it? We talked a little bit last week about this. What order of reality is it? Is it when Ishwara, when the creation, manifest creation, the infinite knowledge that we call the Lord, takes a form in the creation, the question is, what order of reality is that? Is it Vyavahara? Is it Paramarthika? Is it Paribhasika? Those are your choices. No other choices. So those are the choices. Those are the three choices. Obviously, it's not Paramarthika, because that's just non-dual consciousness, which is changeless. It's not Paramartika. It's also not quite right to say Vyavaharika, because Vyavahara is the shared reality that is the infinite order of laws. And so the Lord is not part of that shared reality. He's the total. And so there's no punya papa, there's no karma involved for taking that form. So they say from Ishvara's standpoint, it is Pratibhasika. The taking, it's a projected reality. Even though within that reality, within this Vyavahara, that form is there. But from the standpoint of, say, Krishna, or from the standpoint of Ishvara, there's not a loss of knowledge. That's why earlier, several verses ago, in explaining this, Krishna says, even though I remain ajaha, birthless, free from birth, avyaya atma, free from any type of change or any type of loss of knowledge, abiding still as the Lord of all beings, right? Ishwara, the Ishwara of all beings, abiding as that, with remaining as that, I take this birth. Remaining that I take this birth. And so that means with full knowledge from the standpoint of Ishvara, of Krishna as being Ishvara, with no loss on the part of Ishvara, this phenomena happens. And so that's, so as Swamiji says, you know, you can take that as the writing of Vyasa, in his writing of the Bhagavad Gita, or the portrayal of, as a portrayal of a story. He said in the Vedas, they don't really talk about avatar in the Vedas. They talk in all the Puranas, the avatar, this concept of avatar is there. You know? And so, but however you take it is up to you. If you take it, like in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and these two epics, they're called, just to kind of understand, but there's a lot going on in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and there's Krishna the avatar, Rama the avatar. In both of them, those are both called itihasas. Itihasa means itiha-asa. Thus it was said. So, even though it can be embellished, the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, traditionally, they're viewed as a portrayal of something that actually was. When they think of an avatara, we're talking about someone who actually was. Not as mythology. You might say it's mythology. That's up to you. But that's not how it's held in the tradition. It's held as being something, a portrayal of the way that the creation is. Now, in terms, Swamiji also goes on a little aside on this. In terms of Vedanta, all of it is mitya. So it doesn't not going to hurt whether you say, well, I don't think there's such a thing as an avatar, or, you know, I don't accept it. How could that be, you know? However you want, whatever your kind of scientific background is, or I don't believe that, it can't be. Doesn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. The mityatva you can understand. And you know another thing, just for the Western mind and heart, which has grown up in a whole different condition in a totally different way. You can see that when things get out terribly out of balance, something happens to right it. In fact, Jung called it enantiodromia. When something goes to an extreme in the creation, when
what
something
do you call it?
Never mind, it's a long word. Enantiodromia. When something, I mean, he uses big words sometimes. When something goes really to an extreme, there'll be something in the creation to oppose it, to right it. And you can view that. It's very interesting to look at that. You see these extreme things, and then you see something that comes in to right it. It's a beautiful thing to just think about the ongoing strength of Dharma. If you think like this, see, if you think of Dharma not only as what is right action for the individual, but as the very essence of the creation, the order, the infinite order of the creation, that Dharma goes on churning. It goes on churning. And in the end, it will win. Because it is, the laws are the Dharma. Right? And so the laws which are the Dharma will eat up and consume the Adharma. the adharma will be eaten up by the structure that actually is. And so that structure that actually is produces what it produces to write the universe, to write the universe in terms of dharma. And so in the tradition, this idea of avatara is very, very firmly there. And, you know, and I think it's beautiful. It's and it makes sense from one standpoint, depending on what your vantage point. But from a certain vantage point, it makes sense. So here, he says, again, tada atmanam srajami aham. When things are out of balance like that, when the dharma is being destroyed, at that point, I create myself. Okay? So let's look at this next. Why do you create yourself? He says, paripranaya sadhunam. Paripranaya sadhunam. Vinashaya cha dushkritam. Vinashaya cha dushkritam. Dharma samstapanarthaya. Dharma samstapanarthaya. Sambhavami yuge yuge. Sambhavami yuge yuge. Paritranaya sadhunam. Vinashaya cha dushkritam. Dharma samstapana arthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. He says, just a really continuation of the last verse, he says, paritranaya sadhunam, for the protection, dative case, paritrana is protection, all the way around, complete protection. In order to for protecting the sadhus. Sadhu here just doesn't mean sannyasi. The sadhus are the good, the dharmis. So paritranaya sadhunam, vinashaya cha dushkritam, and for destroying the dushkritas, destroying, putting an end to the evildoers. those who do adharma. Swamiji said he didn't like the idea, you know, of mistaking this vinasha as though we're going to kill all these people because they're bad. He didn't want anybody to think that anybody would just come and kill them because they're bad. So he put in brackets, in parentheses, converting. Convert those people who are doing wrong, right? Who are causing pain. Remember that punya and papa and adharma. What is adharma really? It's himsa, right? It's causing injury. It's causing pain to others, to cultures, to the world, to beings, to living beings. It's causing pain. So those people that are causing pain on all different levels, not just physical pain, but emotional pain, psychological pain, doing damage on all levels to the world and to other living beings, those people need to change. They need to be converted over. They need to be brought back to dharma. So it's not kind of an eye for an eye, well, you're bad, so... It's bringing people back away from the adharma, from the causing pain. So in order to protect the good, because again, dharma is held in the dharmi. The dharmi is the one who's holding it. Dharma, dharmi. And the adharma is held in the adharmi. Right? It doesn't have a life of its own like that. And so if you're going to destroy the adharma, right, you have to destroy the adharmi. What does it mean to destroy the adharmi? Well, it means to convert them to dharma. Another interesting thing, say you kill off the adharmi, and will they just take another birth? What's going to convert them? I mean, just because you end a life doesn't change the disposition of the person. Right? So the disposition of the person, in order to destroy the adharma, the adharmi has to change, because as long as a person's a samsari, they're taking birth after birth after birth, you're not going to destroy them at all. You're just getting rid of them off the planet for the some period of time.
And they'll be back.
But they're going and going and going. So whether they go up to go down to hell worlds or up to heaven worlds or whatever punyapapa they're exhausting, in the end, they have to convert. Just like all of us. Really, just think of it. It's interesting. In terms of what do we want? Say we're seekers. Seekers in the sense that we want the moksha. You want freedom, you know. To do that, the things that are in the way, you know, for antakarana ashuddhi, like the impurities of mind that are causing pain to us, we have to resolve those issues. Until we resolve the issue, whatever it is, it's causing pain. Right? And so it's not exactly killing it. There's no way really to kill it. It has to be resolved. So it's not there in the buddhi anymore, that your buddhi is not subject to that particular way of thinking or that particular complex or whatever it is. And so that destruction of, it's a destruction of adharma and the effects of adharma. We're all suffering from our own adharma and the effects of adharma, say when you're growing up, all of the traumas that we've had to undergo as children. So we're suffering our own adharma and the effects of adharma. All of these things have to be resolved. They have to be changed and converted, in a sense. So that what my antakarana, what my actions, and how I think and how I feel are rooted in dharma. Right? And for a jnani also, the behavior of a jnani, one who has self-knowledge, it is rooted in dharma. Once a person has antakarana shuddhi, when we first come to knowledge, you know, there's still a lot of things that the antakarana, the mind, has to work through. There's just a lot of conditioning, a lot of stuff that we've brought with us. Those things have to be worked through. They have to be changed. You know, we have to be with them. We have to process them, all of that. Mm-hmm. Behavior that's rooted in adharma, because I needed this to be happy, and I needed this to be happy, and I needed this to be happy, so I behaved improperly in this way and that way. Or, you know, you got in my way somehow because I wasn't able to fulfill a desire because of you. And so the bitter and the anger and the resentment around those obstructions, you know, all of that has to be worked through. And one by one I have to let go of all of these things. That's the vairagya. You know, I have to come to a place where, yes, at one time I really wanted that terribly and I needed that to be happy and you were really an obstacle to that and so I did hate you, that's all true. You don't have to confess to anybody, but you have to know it for yourself. But now I don't need that and so the pressure is off you also. Mm-hmm. It's true. When I don't need it, then the pressure is off the obstructions. But that's the growth, that's the vairagya, and it has to happen in all of the little nooks and crannies in our psyche, where we're still hanging on really, really tightly. So that process of letting go of old stuff continues until it's not there anymore. New stuff we don't really pick up. Why would we pick up new stuff? For when a person has knowledge, you know, you're going to be living out your prarabdha, the karmas that come, you know, as you finish out your life. Say you're halfway through your life, you gain knowledge. Now, what new stuff are you, I mean, really gain knowledge, you know. Now, the way you relate to the world is different now. So, but you still have a lot of old baggage, a lot of habits. That has to be worked through, but you're not picking up new stuff. And so as that works through, as the old stuff works through, then what is natural for a human being's behavior is dharma. Dharma is what a person normally is. You are normally dharmic. You are not dharmic because you're confused. You know, I need this. That's what it amounts to. What about when you don't feel that way? Then what are the natural emotions that are there for a person? You can see it even in day-to-day, in your day-to-day life. When you're not confused, when you're not needy, when you don't have something, need something to be a particular way, how are you naturally? You're naturally at peace. You're naturally kind. You're naturally loving. You're naturally caring. you'll naturally lend a hand. There's no absolutely no reason not to. It's just natural, spontaneous behavior of the creation. It's Ishwar's behavior. Does it look like that? It's Ishwar's behavior. There's nothing interfering with Ishwar's behavior. There's no jiva in there screwing it up. See what I mean? No jiva coming in and complicating things. No ajnanam there complicating things. So the behavior is naturally dharmic. For an ajnani, this dharma has to be taught, and we have kind of the rules, you know, and teachings to follow. And if we don't follow those teachings that are kind of putting this natural dharma into a code, we find if we don't follow those codes, we are naturally punished, not by somebody else, but by the very nature of dharma itself. It's just like putting your hand in a fire. You're naturally hurt by it. If you do an unkind act, you suffer from it, whether anybody else has seen you do it or not. There's a natural payback in that way. And so the universe teaches us, right? But there's a natural code because people have learned along the way, and also we say the Vedas and the scriptures, revealed knowledge, has taught us these codes to try to help us. You know, so that we don't have to put our hand in all of the various fires that exist, all of the subtle fires, all the physical fires, to try to help us. But for a jnani, that behavior is natural because my raga, dvesha, likes and dislikes, passions, are not in the way clouding my behavior. Right? All of that means the raga, dveshas are there because of the ajnana. When the ajnana is gone, then I'm free from all of that. So here he says, so in order to protect the good people who are following dharma, kind of following the natural codes that have been put out, and then to convert or get rid of this adharma, you know, to put things back in order, to get a reasonable order going, not 20% dharma and 80% adharma, to get a workable order where people can live, survive, and have a life in a society that's organized. For that, I come. Then, so those two things. And he says, dharma sanstapanarthaya, in order, to put it in short, in order to establish dharma. It actually means to reestablish the dharma. For the sake, for the purpose, for the sake of reestablishing dharma. Sanstapanam, making it firm. So in order to make the dharma firm, then he says what? Sambhavami yuge yuge. In each era, in each yuga, yuge yuge, means in each one, repeating like that. Sambhavami, I manifest myself. I become. I take birth in order to protect the world, in order to protect dharma, in order to protect goodness. For that reason, I come. So now, let's do this next verse. Janmakaram nachame divyam. Janma karma cha me divyam evam yo veti tat putaha evam yo veti tat putaha tyaktva deham punarjanma tyaktva deham punarjanma naiti mameti sorjana naiti mameti sorjana. Janma karma cha me divyam evam yaha veti tatputaha tyaktva deham punarajanma na eti mam eti saha arjuna. So janma, the birth, and karma, and actions, janma karma cha, the birth and actions of me. These divyam means aishwarya. The divyam means they're divine. But he means it's Ishwar talking. So he's talking in this order from me, aishwarya. This birth that comes from me is Ishwara, of the avatar, and the actions of myself is Ishwara. for this divine birth and activity of mine. Evam yaha veti tattvataha, the one who knows it in this manner, in reality, he who, yaha veti, he who knows tattvataha, in reality, evam, in this manner, tyaktva deham, having given up this body, means when this physical body drops, when it dies, punar janma na eti, another birth he doesn't get. He doesn't take another birth. Mam eti saha Arjuna, O Arjuna, he comes to me directly. Okay. So now, in order to, you have to remember that Krishna is just teaching this quickly, right? And so we spend a lot of time on every verse, and so you can't, maybe don't remember what he said just a few verses ago, but he started this on verse, if you just remember on, like on verse 5, he says, he starts out saying, because Arjuna had asked him about this, how is it that you can teach Vivaswan, who came at the beginning of the creation, and now here you are teaching me, how is that possible? Because he's talking to Krishna. How could that happen? I don't understand that. And then, so it doesn't make sense. Actually, Arjuna knew that, really, but he wanted to hear about it. So
what?
Arjuna actually did know, because he has known all in the Mahabharata. He knew that Krishna was the Lord, and that there, and had treated him as the Lord also. And that's why he asked Krishna, do you ride in my chariot for this war? I don't need your army. Let Duryodhana have your whole huge army. I don't want that. I just want you, and you can ride in my chariot. You can be the driver. That would be perfect. Why? Because he knows. You know? And Krishna was kind of known also as being very special like that. So Arjuna knew. But it's still a very neat question to ask. And so, because I would want to hear all about that. All those details, you know. And Shankara in the Bhasha says that Vyasa had Arjuna write this question so that it would be understood in the Bhagavad Gita exactly who Arjuna was. It gives an opportunity for Arjuna to talk, for Krishna to talk about himself. So in this verse 5, answering Arjuna's question, what he says first is, you know, hey Arjuna, many, many births, countless births have gone by for both you and me. The difference is that I know all of them. I know all of those births. And you don't know any of them. For you, because as a jiva, you won't know all of your previous births. But for me, as the Lord, I know all of them. I know everything that has come and everything that will be. All I know, he says. And then he says, he explains to Arjuna, even though being free from birth, and avyaya atma, my mind being immutable knowledge, or you can take it the self being changeless, it's true on both levels, and bhutanam ishwaraha apisan, even though being the Lord of all beings, being immutable, changeless, being birthless. He's talking Brahman. I am the self of all beings. I am Brahman, the changeless self, birthless self, the one who's the self of all beings, the Atma, the self of all beings, and the Lord of the entire creation. I'm the one from whom the creation has come, the one by whom it is sustained, and the one into whom it resolves. Even though being all of that, he says, controlling, managing, adhishtanam, Arishtaya, holding my own prakriti. The prakriti is the maya. Prakriti and maya are the same. So controlling my own maya, he says, sambhavami atma mayaya. I take this birth, right, through my maya. In other words, you controlling my maya, I take this birth. Now, see what he's saying? He's saying, I am Brahman. I am the one birthless, changeless self, who is the very self of the whole creation. You have to get now. So he's just capsulizing the whole vision here, which he has spent chapter 2, 3, and 4 teaching Arjuna. And so now he's bringing all that back because he's already given Arjuna the entire vision. You know, in chapter 2, in fact, it was finished. In chapter 3, Karma Yoga was finished. Krishna could have stopped, but Arjuna had more questions and kept him going. Right? But the teaching itself, if you teach chapter 2, even has enough even of the Karma Yoga. You know, Arjuna asked a question, he got chapter 3. Now he's asking more questions, and it'll just go on unfolding like that. But remember, the whole vision has been given in chapter 2 and 3. Now, in light of this question, now here, Krishna is bringing the whole vision back. I am birthless. Myself is, I'm avyaya, avyaya atma. Myself is immutable. I am all knowledge. I'm the Lord of all beings. The Lord of all beings being the one from whom the creation has come, sustained and resolves. And being all of that, controlling my own maya, I take this birth through maya. So now he says, then he talks a little bit with the verses we've just done, saying why he does that. I do it to protect dharma. You know, when a dharma has risen and a dharma is being destroyed, I come in order to save the dharmis and to destroy the adharmis. For that reason, every yuga, in order to really to reestablish dharma, for that reason, I take this birth, right? Controlling my own maya. Now he says, this divine karma, janma, birth, and karma of mine, right? The divine birth and karma of mine, for those who understand it in this way that I've explained to you, in truth, understand the reality of it, what it is in truth, those people are not born again. Those people come to me alone. And now this come to me, what does it mean? So eti, when you say eti, you can translate it as come, but it means they obtain me. They gain me alone. What does it mean to gain? Because in fact, those who know in truth, what do they know? That this manifest creation, this manifest knowledge is mitya. What is the satyam? What is the paramarthika satyam? Is Brahman, is the self, the one self. From this one self, this vyavaharika satyam comes, the creation comes, is sustained, and resolves. When this creation is there in order to protect the beings, I manifest as an avatara, which is also mitya. The creation is mitya, the avatara is mitya, the birth is mitya, the whole, the dharma is mitya, the adharma is mitya, the whole thing is mitya. But when you understand this whole, and exactly the truth of what I'm talking about, because even though it's all mitya, within the mitya creation, there's dharma and adharma. When there's dharma and adharma, things become out of order. When things come out of order within this vyavaharika creation, within this empirical shared reality, when it becomes out of order, it has to right itself. And this is when I take my birth in order to facilitate that righting itself. So you can even say, we look at the big avatars like Krishna and Rama and Narasimha, and there's so many different avatars. These are the ones we look at, the ones that come at a given during when the adharma is overwhelming. When the adharma is so overwhelming that there's no possibility of the dharmis correcting it. But if you look at it, so that's what we mean by the big avatars. But there's such a thing also in the Puranas and in the tradition called Shesha avatars. The Shesha avatars are the little avatars, what they're called partial avatars, that come in particular situations in order to right the situation. Something is needed, some vibhuti. Vibhuti means some special manifestation is necessary in order to correct a given situation, to bring the situation back into dharma. And so those shesha avataras, or those just watching those corrections in the creation, it's an exciting thing to look at the creation that way, to watch it correct itself. And then when we're talking about shesha avataras, you can look at different individuals, different situations, different ways that correction takes place, where you stop and you say, ah, there is a God. God is great. You know those moments you say, oh, there really is a God. God is great. Because you're seeing dharma, you're seeing a correction take place. And it moves you. You notice it. So those are the little shesha avatars. So he says, those who know this, who understand me, who understand this, what I'm saying, for those in truth, the tatvataha, in reality, all of what I'm talking about here, for those people, there is no more janma. Those people obtain me alone. Why? Because to really understand the whole picture, the ajnanam is removed. What do you understand in understanding the whole picture is that I am that. You understand the Mahavakya. That satyam, that paramartika satyam, which is the truth of Krishna, which he said just a few verses ago, ajaha, avyaya atma, unborn, changeless. That's the paramartika satyam. Those who understand the truth of that have to understand I am that. That's what the whole teaching has been in the Bhagavad Gita up to this time. You understand that that Bhagavad, what is Ishwara, the truth of Ishwara, the paramartika satyam, the conscious being which is changeless. I am that conscious being. And so for me as a jiva, there is no more jiva. Because I'm Ishwara. This self which is the Lord's self, is myself. So where is the jiva? The ajnanam is gone that has caused that identification for me to take myself, my being, to be this. So when this prarabdha is gone, when the body drops, that's what they say, tektwa deham, when the body drops, this punar janma, this second, another birth, na eti, that doesn't, and one doesn't go to another birth. Because who's going to be born? If you know who you are, where is there birth for you? You never were born. You never will be born. And where is the jiva? The jiva's gone. Already this life itself, the jiva is gone. It's just a dukkha bija. It's the continuation of the prarabdha. But yourself as the atma, you're not a jiva, you're the atma. And so what is left for you when this body drops? The jiva is not there. So who is there? Who are you? What is left for you is who you are. Who are you? Ishwara. Because if I am Brahman, and the manifest knowledge is natural expression of Brahman, then I am Brahman, whose natural expression is this manifest knowledge, which is the creation, and that's who I am. There isn't now a false identification with jiva in reference to this jiva. This little piece of ajnanam is no more. There's still an infinite number of jivas, but this particular piece of ajnanam isn't there. So from this standpoint, there is no more jiva experiencing the creation. From this standpoint, all that there is left is me, Ishwara. Myself is Ishwara. So that's why it says that person becomes me itself. And now it's going to kind of reunite after this little episode of describing the avatar. Now he's just going to pick up and start going on with this vision again after this little aside. And he went on this aside in some detail because Arjuna asked him. He wanted an explanation, and so Krishna gave it to him. It'd be very nice, wouldn't it? To have Ishwara's avatar to be your teacher, and then you say, well, tell me, how did this happen? What is it really like? Nice. Okay, let's take a minute. Purnamidam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
This idea, do you think this is a culturally specific, the rebirths and what have you? I mean, what happens to a jiva that gets born outside of his whole culture, you know? Okay.
They're in for a big surprise.
I mean, it seems like...
Well, what I mean is, by that, that's an interesting question, actually. I mean, I think... you can accept, you know, the kind of the transmigration of the soul or not. Mm-hmm. But say you accept it in the scheme of things. Like most people in the world do, actually. Some of the 66% of the world just takes it as that's part of their religious heritage and what they accept. Okay, so say that is the truth. Say you accept that is true because you can't prove it really. It can make all kinds of sense to you. The Shastra says that it's true. You know, but that's what it is. And say you accept it's true. Another person doesn't accept it's true. But you know who's going to win out? The one who's right. Right? So, but what I mean is, if say it is a fact that the soul transmigrates. Say that's a fact. Whether you believe it or not is totally irrelevant to the reality. It's not like the reality is going to change because you don't believe it. You know? But that's... Also, you have to accept that that model of the universe, which is presented by the Shastra, by the Upanishads, by the whole tradition, this part of it is a belief, even though it's logical and there's a lot of different anecdotal evidence you can give for it, but still it's belief. That there are different levels of heaven worlds and hell worlds and all of that, that's also a belief. How can you prove it? But if you have that Shraddha in the Shastra that is giving you this knowledge, the same Shastra, the same scripture that's giving you Atmajnanam, that's giving you self-knowledge, which is not a belief. That's direct, immediate knowledge. That's not just some sort of a hypothetical. That's something that you actually recognize, you actually see it. And there's on logic in terms of your experience, in terms of your logic and consistency with the Shastra, it is all there. So that's what we call aparoksha, direct immediate knowledge. You can't say you don't know. You can't. You would, if you know, you could never say this is just a belief. This is just an idea. But when you get to the things that are beyond your scope, we're not just talking about the Atma, we're talking about Satyamitya, right, which is all immediate. We're talking about heaven worlds and hell worlds and punya and papa and even dharma and adharma leading to punya and papa, to karma. All of these things are about the structure. They structure your reality. Now, one thing I would say about it, though, because I think it's that people make a real mistake in just dismissing it, is this. Just like, say, any given truth, if it is true, it will hold up to your experience. It will hold up all the way around. So these things that are said that make sense when you understand them, do they hold up to your experience? I would give these things that you write off as a belief. We might call them in Vedanta, I think, and within the tradition, we'd say indirect knowledge, because there's Shraddha in the scripture. And this is what the scripture says. And so we take it as indirect knowledge. That's also very important, because in Vyavahara, there is so much that we take as indirect knowledge because we have Shraddha in the source. Say, for instance, like in science, or if you're reading a book on geography, for instance, you have Shraddha in the source, if it's a reputable source, that's right, textbooks, etc., that we take that knowledge as indirect knowledge. So say you have Shraddha in the Vedas, they have given you direct knowledge, you have Shraddha, you at least will give the knowledge that Veda has to tell you, you at least will analyze it and do vichara on it with respect. Right? Because there's a Shraddha there. You don't take yourself to be so intellectually superior that you can just dismiss what something is saying. You at least give it a chance to
rather arrogant.
To analyze it. There's a respect there. You know? And that's all. It's not saying accept or reject. It's saying you approach something with some respect. And I think that's an attitude that has certain beauty in it.
You know, but if it's true, though, and the jivas recite, keep being reborn.
Recycle?
Hopefully not. I think it's rather tragic to be born outside of the whole system, because it wouldn't be available to you.
But you're not born outside of the whole system. That's also improper. Because say you think of there's one creation, multidimensional, infinite number of laws. Your karmas will put you here, or put you here, or put you here, this time around.
Yeah, or insect.
Or insect, yes, you could be that lucky. Whatever. But it's all part of one infinite system. You're never outside of that system. Because one creation.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
So, on this thing, on the avatar idea, to me, this thing is intriguing. It's hard for me to completely comprehend it or accept it totally. But you know, it's like really evocative of something, and it's really bizarre. I mean, I guess the way I see it is that, like when he says that if you understand this, what an avatar is, and that I'm an avatar, then you'll come to me. You'll be essentially a yani. I can see that if you really understand this, you'd be a yani, because it contains, you know, the basic Upanishadic teaching.
Understand that Ishwara is Brahman.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you'd understand the nature of the whole and its relationship with Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, one could be a yani and not necessarily believe in the idea of...
You wouldn't have to believe in the avatara.
Right.
But probably your attitude would be one of not disbelieving or believing. It would be probably one of really not knowing.
Okay.
Because I would say like this, because this is now just me, this isn't Vedanta or anything, but to say I know or I don't know is beyond your means of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so then you would say, this is what the Shruti, this is what the Shastra is saying. Whether it's saying on what level of reality it's telling the story, is it absolute? Is it really Jivahar? Is this really how it is, or is this a story form that has been handed down in order to give a message? Or I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
You could say my upbringing has not. I just don't have the conditioning to be able to just believe that that's true, and I can't. I don't have the knowledge to say that it's not true. That to me is appropriate.
So the one thing that sticks with me is that, so again, I don't know if this is at all, you know, accurate, but I can sort of see it as being that the system as a whole, the universe as a whole, when it gets out of balance in some ways, may do something to restore the balance. And the intelligence in it and everything will do that. But then to conceive that an individual who is manifested to assist the restoring of balance in the universe, who has a subtle and a gross body and therefore has limited sense perceptions and everything, and a limited mind in a sense, would have the total knowledge of the number of hairs on the head of somebody in China, for example, is a little bit beyond.
But in a way, they're saying something different than that. That's why the Pratibhasika. That's why they're bringing in the Pratibhasika. because it's not a real birth. It's a manifestation, but it's not a real birth. So they have that same, that's why they deal with that. That's why they deal with it that way. Yeah. They don't look, they don't view the avatar as a real birth.
Yeah, but it's somewhere between a, yeah, anyway, the whole thing of Pratibhasika from the point of view of Ishvara is also,
you know,
where is it from our point of view? Because, in other words, you know, normally Pratibhasika from our point of view is just...
From your point of view, it'll still look like Vyavahara.
Right.
But from Ishvara's or Krishna's point of view, it's not Vyavahara. Because Krishna is Ishvara at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea. The way, if I go to a lucid dream, I understand it in that way. If I enter a lucid, say I have a lucid dream, so I'm aware this is me, the dream is me. And if I enter into the dream, I have the power to enter into the dream, I am both me and the character that has entered into the dream. I'm both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Maya, you know.
From the point of view of the other dream characters, they would see
the person
as being a real person in their order of reality. Okay.
But, you know, I mean, this isn't something for Westerners. It's not something to convince you of. You don't need it for Vedanta. But for me, I like it. And for me, that it works. But then what can you say to me about that?
Well,
for me,
you, it's a you like it because Vedanta gave you the truth, gave you something that was true. And so within that Veda, it also presents these other beliefs. So
yes, that's true. But there's another things too, is that I find just in my own studies of mythology and of different peoples, everyone resonates with a certain. Well, for instance, if I'm reading the Ramayana, or the Mahabharata, you know those all the stories. All of it really resonates with me. Some people, if they're reading like the Greek gods and goddesses, those resonate deeply with those people.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, the Christian myth resonates deeply, and it speaks. There's a numinosity. For some people, it's Judaism. For some people, it's, you know, Buddhism or Islam. It's like the myth of it. The story is something that holds me and contains me and has a numinosity. I consider that really sacred. But it doesn't have to be the same for everyone.
But it seems like that there's a deep association to the Prapta Kama there.
Mm-hmm.
That you have that resonance with Vedanta, because I feel that in myself, totally. I mean, I knew that the first time I entered into India, that's where I'm going with my life.
Yeah.
You know, I had Nadi readings which were confirming that and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what you were saying is, like, for somebody who has a Greek connection, maybe they just spend a few more lifetimes in that world. So it's also kind of re-emphasizing the point that there might be reincarnation that creates these deep vasanas in us that we resonate with certain fields of knowledge of consciousness, right?
I think that's true. But, say, take all of that. We're still working, all of that's all kind of within mitya, within the creation.
Mm-hmm.
What Vedanta is of a different level.
Yeah.
You know? Vedanta has to do with that this is mitya.
Mm-hmm.
And that the truth is satyam. Mm-hmm. And the Mahavakya. If you say, really, what is the Upanishad?
Mm-hmm.
It's the Mahavakya.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And so on the avatar, now, can I go over it?
Yeah.
The avatar, they're also non-human avatars. Right.
There are in
like,
the
like a tortoise,
like the tortoise, and that was to hold up something. I don't know them all.
And then there's supposed to be
Narasimha, half man, half lion,
non-sentient avatars, or in other words, are there avatars that weren't animal or
not
person?
That I know.
Or
something? It gets a little blurry, doesn't
it? I don't know about that.
Okay.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, I don't know either. No, okay. I thought I heard something about that. But
I know
I
the tortoise, but I don't know of the non-human ones. Parasurama, Rama, Narasimha. You know them all?
I remember the 10
But they were all.
Was there all either animal?
Yeah, there was a pig. Yeah. Wasn't there a pig? Yeah, no, hog and stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
A boar.
A boar.
My question is this. I've heard you say, and Swamiji say, that we can only get to Ishwara through the Shruti. You know, you can get to like that, you know, the Satyamritya, you can understand that. I mean, you can be a jnani, you can see, this is myself. But Ishwara has to be given to us through the Shruti. But what I'm wondering is how does that, because I would think that even if you were a jnani but you didn't know about Ishwara because somehow you became a jnani, just, you know, somehow, but you didn't have Shruti to give you Ishwara, but still you would see within the creation the order, because that's pretty obvious. So how is that, because to me Ishwara is the order. So is there some other distinction that some sort of more of a distinction of what makes Ishwara Ishwara, what the Shruti is giving us.
Tell me what would be the difference between seeing the creation as an infinite order, and we just call it Mother Nature, and Ishwara. What would be the difference between Mother Nature, because even in science, without any religion, you know, or spirituality, you can see that this is an infinite order. It's mathematical. That's obvious, you know, that there's like a mathematical order that's all pervasive to the creation.
Right.
So we can say this is the creation.
Right.
What makes the creation which has infinite order in the Ishwara?
Yeah, that actually is my question. I don't really know. I mean,
what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, you could say like this, you know, we could say infinite intelligence, and then maybe, you know, then that would imply a being, but I don't understand that. Even to me, the manifestation of intelligence...
Of knowledge.
Yeah, of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Is that the same as, say, Jnana Shakti? Would that be the same, in a sense?
Well, we have those words, Jnana Shakti, Kriya Shakti,
right.
You know, Icha Shakti, all of that. That's not really... I guess we could use those words, but I think when we say manifest knowledge, that's why we always go also... Why did Swamiji use the word manifest knowledge? He's the one that coined that, you know, rather than saying sarvajnaha, we say sarvajnatvam, sarvavit. Ishwara is knows everything, omniscient in a general way of being knowing I am the whole, not with words, but I am the whole. And sarvavit, knowing every particular. Swamiji said, it is manifest knowledge. Why did he choose to say manifest knowledge? Was so that you could relate it to your own experience. Because when you have manifest knowledge, that's why he'll use this example. If I ask you right now to think of a meadow, right? Which we've done. He's done also and got a lot of guided meditation. You think of a meadow, that meadow is now manifest knowledge. It was there in unmanifest condition. It is now manifest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you can make the meadow complex with, you know, the sun and clouds and individuals and trees and birds and animals. So I say a complex manifest knowledge and a guided meditation I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So now that's coming out of your unmanifest condition into manifest.
Capacity.
Okay, now, here it is, this manifest knowledge. I am there, the conscious being. The manifest knowledge, what does it mean to say manifest knowledge? It means that vritti, that thought modification, is known. Right? And there's a sense of self. Right? If I ask you to have, just you as a jiva, to have a thought, you pervade the thought, you are the self of the thought is known, it is your thought. Right? So now when we say Ishwara, it's not just Mother Nature where the creation is unknown. I pervade the entire creation. I am the self of the entire creation. The entire creation is known as a manifest knowledge. Just as if you manifest something out of your unconscious or out of your... all of your knowledge right now, except for this moment, is an unmanifest condition. Now you bring it to manifestation. Now, you are the self of that. Right? You pervade it. You're the being of it. It comes from you, is sustained by you, goes back into you. It is one conscious entity, except when we say manifest knowledge as for Ishvara, it is infinite. It, infinite knowledge. That is the manifestation, is the entire creation on every level that's manifest right now. That entire, whatever is manifest right now in totality on every level, that is Ishvara. And Ishvara is the one for whom that manifestation is totally known and is the self of it. So just like if I have a huge vritti, I am the self of that. It is mine. It is me. There's no distance between me and it. It is known. That's what he means by manifest knowledge. The Shruti gives us that. How can you, as a jiva, now, and also, that this manifest knowledge projects results, from beginningless time. How can a jiva have that knowledge? You can't have any. There's nothing that you have available to you that can give you that knowledge.
But you know what sort of gets, what it suggests to me that I think I can connect with this, which also relates to this, what's the difference between Ishvara as the whole and sort of Mother Nature, or like a systems view of the universe as an orderly system, you know. And so what I can relate to is that there's, it's almost like this, tell me if you think this is correct, is that there's this quality of kind of like personhood, you know, that is fundamental to the universe.
Yes, personhood is fundamental to the universe.
A conscious beingness is fundamental to the universe.
That's
it's
exactly
more than
it.
Just an unconscious system of forces that happen to be orderly.
It's personhood. That's what I say, yeah. Purusha Sukta, in that famous chant. Personhood is the nature of Brahman. Right? And that personhood is the very self, the very truth of the universe. So the universe is never without personhood. Mm-hmm. So what is the relationship of manifest knowledge to the personhood? Really, I mean, the manifest knowledge is the manifest knowledge of the being, the person, which is Satchidananda. Satchidananda is the person. Doesn't have any arms or legs. Doesn't have a mind, doesn't have anything. It is the person, is Satchidananda. And the person, which is infinite, the infinite Satchidananda, consciousness, existence, infinite consciousness, existence, that is the me. That's the self, that's the me. From that, manifest knowledge projects and resolves from beginningless time.
So where's the personhood coming in?
The personhood is the very nature of consciousness. What gives you...
So that's the me then?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. So they're kind of...
Yeah, the personhood and the me are the same.
So what's lacking in this concept of Mother Nature? What is absent?
We usually, when we think of Mother Nature just in science, you don't think of consciousness. You just think of
a clockwork universe,
an inert universe.
Yeah, even if you're sophisticated and you see it as a whole systems theory or something.
It's still inert.
It's still inert, yes.
Okay.
Now, there's no person there. Behind
so Gaia, Miss Gaia, Mrs. Gaia is there.
But Mrs. Gaia doesn't talk to
me. That's good. I think you got it, Hal.
Yeah, because there's still a distinction.
It's pretty mind-blowing, actually.
There's still kind of a distinction between being able to recognize that all of this is myself, that all of this is Satchidananda, and then needing the Shruti to tell us about Ishvara.
Okay, but you have to see,
how can you know that
the creation is cyclical, beginningless, and that it itself reflects consciousness? Like your thought, that your thought is known, right? That's why I'm using reflex consciousness. If you don't want reflex consciousness, which Swamiji is getting away from because it's a tricky idea, he says manifest knowledge. But when he says manifest knowledge, that's so that you understand that manifest knowledge means that it's known, right? So if you don't want to say reflects consciousness, think of the whole universe as itself. It is being known. And it has a person, the being, the me-ness. And creation is known and it has a me, which is Brahman, which is
But then basically that sounds to me like you need Shruti for everything. Maybe this is just a sort of,
You need Shruti for... You don't need Shruti for... You need Shruti to reveal to you through that teaching methodology, and maybe different traditions around the world have their own way of doing it, but within this tradition, you need the Shruti to reveal to you the aparokshatvam, the nature of yourself, the infinite nature of yourself. Right. That's direct, immediate knowledge.
Right.
That's not something that remains, it's the indirect.
Right.
You need, and so that's direct, immediate. To understand the satya mitya of your experience, direct, immediate.
Okay.
But then to extend to the cyclical nature of the creation and infinite nature of Ishwara, you need the Shruti to explain what that is to you.
And that part
to be the one from whom the creation comes, this is critical to the understanding of Ishwara, that Sat Chit Ananda, the Satyam Jnanam Anantam, the pure infinite consciousness, is the one from whom the creation comes, is sustained and resolves. How could you know that?
That's
key
there. Yeah. That's in the Upanishads. That's not.
That's the Upanishads.
Okay.
It's all through the Vedas, but it's what the vision of the Upanishads.
It is in the Upanishads.
Yes, it is in the Upanishads, definitely.
Yeah.
And that's what in Panchadashi, that's what Vidyaranya has been going
he's
on
been
and on
quoting, yeah.
about this. While Vidyaranya has worked in Panchadashi, is that he's having the Shruti first is explaining the Ishwara, the nature of Ishwara, the one from whom the creation comes, is sustained and resolves. And then, through the teaching methodology, makes the student recognize I am that Ishwara.
But saying you need the Shruti doesn't mean that it's indirect.
No.
Only going to be indirect.
No.
No, it is.
For the Shruti, for
the
Atma-jnana, direct aparokshajnana. That's direct and immediate.
What is indirect in a sense?
It is
that it projects from, projects the results. That would always be indirect.
That's right.
Yeah.
You can never, that's right. Will always be indirect.
Well, it's so very frustrating with Swamiji. He would say my Vedanta was perfect, but I just didn't understand Ishwara. And then it would stop, you know. So it's a...
I'm sorry, what is always direct? Indirect? I didn't quite...
How would you ever know
that
the creation is cyclical?
From
Brahman, the creation projects, is sustained and resolved from beginningless time. How would you know that? Because you can't get beyond time as a jiva.
Right.
If you don't have that means of knowledge.
So
even though when you learn it, you know, you can do some logical extension and understand how that would be
but
and that makes
you
sense.
Sort of know, well, okay,
but there's direct knowledge also, right? I mean,
yeah, there's a
direct knowledge is of yourself. The Sat Chit Ananda is direct immediate knowledge.
Yeah.
And the mityatva of the creation is direct immediate knowledge.
But you
so there's no extension and resolution. I mean, there's no projection and resolution in that direct knowledge, right?
No, that's as is.
Mm-hmm.
That's clean.
Well, does the universe sustaining and being cyclic, does that become direct knowledge?
No.
That
it's cyclical and all
yeah.
of that? No. That's from the Shruti.
Yeah.
So you have an understanding of what the Shruti
you
says.
You have an understanding of it then.
But you can't experience it.
Oh, okay.
Right? So direct immediate means if the experience is there, firsthand, you know, and the knowledge reveals what you actually are and what you actually are experiencing is there firsthand, and the knowledge is pointing to it. Here it is.
Mm-hmm.
And your mind sees it.
So it's spontaneous, actually. Direct knowledge is more spontaneous.
It's more spontaneous in that as the knowledge is taking place, you see it, because what is there to be seen is right there. You know. But then when we're talking about the nature of Ishwara, the nature of Maya being beginningless, and the projection and resolution of the creation being a beginningless process and all of that, you know, and then all of the different lokas and punya and papa and the reincarnation of the soul and all of these type of things, because they're away from your immediate experience.
But so there's an oscillation, basically, between direct and indirect knowledge that kind of goes on, right?
Well, there's the direct that is direct no matter what, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that direct will support the indirect, but you will still be indirect.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even though you'll understand it and appreciate it and make sense and all of that,
mm-hmm.
and in the light of what you've learned about the immediate knowledge, it's in a way you can logically extend and you can say, I see no other way that it could be, actually.
Hmm.
You know, but do you need to, is it required to have that indirect knowledge of Ishvara then?
It is required.
That's kind of what we're working on.
Because then it won't.
Because otherwise you don't really get it. Mm-hmm. You know, otherwise you don't really get what this universe is. You know, so if you don't understand manifest knowledge, then actually all you are is a little bubble of consciousness walking through an inert creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Jnani. Right? But you're not a Jnani. It's not a Jnani. And Swamiji was joking. He says, your understanding up to this point is clear, but you haven't understood Ishvara.
Yeah.
If you don't understand Ishvara, what does that mean? There's an inert creation. Really, honestly. Mm-hmm. You don't understand Ishvara, so what is this creation? It's an inert creation, and who are you? You're a bubble of consciousness walking around in it. If this isn't an inert creation, what is it? Ishvara. You know? But if it's an inert creation, your relationship to this creation is much different than if it's not an inert creation. Mm-hmm. If it's an inert creation, you are bound to, you have to be a jiva, right? Maneuvering yourself through this insentient morass that we've got, right? So yeah. There's no, the karma yoga, everything, all of these sadhanas where I recognize myself as part of something greater, you know, all of that becomes, I don't know what it is. It's not sensical.
It's kind of, it feels like it's all about, like what you were saying before, it seems like this polishing of the dharmic interrelationship with life seems like the forefront of this human experience, cleaning up your dharma in some way, coming to resolution with it, right?
That is true, and if you look at every religion in the world, all of the spiritual disciplines, all of them have to do with dharma. Mm-hmm. You know? And gaining a mind that is free from, that is in harmony with dharma, so that it's free, basically free from pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that mind is so, the knowledge comes so naturally to that mind, because the mind isn't in pain. And it's not interacting with the world in a way that is causing pain for itself.
So that's where the Antakarna Shuddhi
is so important.
Kicks in, right?
The Antakarna Shuddhi is so important for gaining a mind, that's purity of mind, for gaining a mind that can really hold this knowledge. And then this knowledge, as you gain it, because we all have enough Antakarna Shuddhi to be mamukshus, to be people who are seekers. That means you have enough antakarna shuddhi. You need more. We all need more. It's all growing and growing and all of that. But there's enough there. And so with that antakarna shuddhi, you gain this knowledge. That knowledge helps your antakarna shuddhi. That antakarna shuddhi helps your knowledge. Your knowledge helps your antakarna shuddhi. And it's a growth process.
Why does it seem that direct knowledge seems to be easy and very obvious? I mean, if you can appreciate when it's unfolded. And the indirect knowledge, or the like Ishvara, is a requires more of an achievement or a gain.
I'm getting tired, so I'm going to answer yours, and then I'm going to talk to okay. Peter, and then we're going to stop because I'm too tired. But if my mind doesn't conk out before I. Oh. It's conking out.
The moment of truth.
Yeah, no, I need get me the battery. Tell me just briefly again, because I want to answer.
The immediate knowledge.
Oh, okay, I know what it is. This is what
it's
it is.
It's so easy, yeah.
I really think that it's lack of vairagya that stops your appreciation of Ishvara. And the reason for that, lack of vairagya, because when I need something to be a certain way, then the relationship with Ishvara can be one of anger. You know? Because I want something to be a certain way. And then I'm trying to force that to take place. And when that type of kartratvam is there, because I want something, kartratvam means doership. When that type of doership is there, and I need this to be a certain way, then that is what's taking focus, and Ishvara is far in the background in a hypothetical. And so as the vairagya starts coming, that dispassion where I
kind of realize more and more and more and more that my ananda really cannot, it's not going to be satisfied by the creation. Mm-hmm. My search for ananda cannot, this creation can't do it. Mm-hmm. And so as I start letting go, then I start appreciating the order of this creation and the beauty of it and the intelligence of it. And when I start appreciating, because I'm out of the picture, I've got more vairagya. Out of the picture meaning I'm not fighting with the creation. And then I start experiencing the manifest intelligence, the wonder of it all, and so then Ishwara is not very far from me. And then when the Shruti is unfolding Ishwara, I said, yeah, that's because you're already appreciating that magnificent intelligence. You know, but when you're still hurting and you're wanting things to be a particular way, that's very far in the background. You know? Yeah. What were you asking, Peter?
Yeah, well, they say that Ishwara is Dharma or Dharma is Ishwara?
Well, we would say when we're looking at the creation as this manifestation, one appreciation of one way to appreciate Ishwara is the fact that there is infinite order. There's an infinite order to it. And so you can say that the manifest knowledge or the infinite intelligence of the creation, all of that are just ways of describing Ishwara. But say if you just say infinite order and leave it at that, then it becomes like an unintelligent creation.
Yeah.
Like the clock. Newton's clock, you know. Ticking away.
And so our dharma is also from Ishwara, right? Because there's only Ishwara.
Well, what if you look at a dharma? A dharma is being handled by dharma. Look at dharma as the infinite order. And as things are, when there's a kind of a going against the order, means you're creating pain. That pain is part of the order. Right?
Yeah.
So, right?
That's the direct.
Yeah. And so we call that creation of pain or what we don't like as a dharma. We say it's going against the order, but really the only thing there is that is order.
Right.
The only thing there really is dharma. But we say there's a dharma because if we're pushing against it in a certain way, it creates so much pain. And we don't want that pain. So we say we want to stay within the order, you know, where I feel at peace.
Yet we sometimes do what we don't want to do, too.
Yes, and then we suffer for it.
Yeah. Until you don't.
If you're doing what you don't want to do, I mean, are you talking about doing a dharma even though you don't want to do it?
Yeah, or? Unconscious things coming up.
Yeah, you know? But unconscious things coming up, those, depending upon you, how are you with them,
mm-hmm.
you can have peace or you can have more suffering.
Right. If I see it as a punishment, right, then it's more suffering.
It's more suffering. Yeah. Or if you're critical or accusatory,
like
more
yourself,
suffering.
Yourself, though.
Yeah. But what if something painful is coming up? Something hurtful is coming up as unconscious material.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you're with it is one of loving and understanding and trying to help. Okay? And then you feel whole inside.
Yeah, but what if you're not capable of doing that in the moment?
Then you suffer.
That's like a general rule, you know?
It is. So say something is coming up, but just like in the real world, somebody comes up and is attacking you and is just a real jerk, and you become a jerk back. You suffer. So say something, you suffer your own jerkiness.
Yeah.
Okay, so say something very hurtful or painful comes up inside. And so you can't handle it, and so you become a jerk toward it. Or nasty or mean or critical or angry or furious. And then you suffer that. Right? And then you learn. But then you learn, okay, that's not the way to treat it. You couldn't handle it that time. Next time, you might be able to.
Well, yeah, because it burns. I mean, after a while, you keep sticking your hand in the fire.
Until you're finally, your hands
burn. You know, some people are very stubborn, you know.
That's right.
Over and over.
That's right. And finally, you give up.
And that's the maturity.
You know the example that I like for myself that works? I love the example of in India, you know, when they have in these villages on their front porches, they'll have these these big vases, pottery vases, huge pottery vases that they'll fill with their nuts. And these pottery vases have just a little tiny hole that the nuts will just fit in almost one by one. They do it to keep the monkeys out. Hmm. And so this will happen is the monkeys will go. They'll stick their hand in and they'll get a handful of nuts. And they can't get their hand out. And so by this time they're making all kinds of noise trying to get their hand out. And the owner of the house comes out with the monkey stick. Because they know. So it comes out and starts beating on the monkey to make the monkey go. All that monkey has to do is let go of the nuts. It won't let go, and it won't let go. It refuses to let go until it's almost beaten to a pulp, and then finally it lets go.
And then that becomes like a life lesson for
you. That one, man?
That's the idea. Listen, think of it.
What about the person that's beating the monkey?
I've got the point.
But you know, if you think of it, this story, like for us, as we gain vairagya and with knowledge, what you learn is you can go to be like the monkey, you get the nuts, but then you see the stick coming, you let go of the nuts and you go. Oh, that's not good. Right. You become very facile at letting go when you get yourself into trouble like that. But until you understand, you hold on to these desires until you're dead. They almost kill you. And then finally you realize that I have to let that go. And when you finally do let it go, I'm talking about the big ones, you know, when you finally do let it go, it's a miracle. And then you realize how much your life had been destroyed in a way by that desire.
So a dharma is actually benign in a way.
The punishment is benign. The pain that it causes.
Yeah.
In the sense that it's just like they say, you know, for the body, physical pain is benign. It hurts like anything, but it's a symptom to tell you something wrong. So say we learn how to listen to pain, emotional pain, and how you are even being with your own emotional pain. Is the way you're being with it a way that is helpful? Or is it making it worse? Right? So we learn after a while. You know?
Okay.